Hello, this is Jane with the News Gazette, dated October 3rd, 2025. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article entitled Dry and Drabber. Orberis, leaf colors won't be as spectacular this season thanks to long-term drought. Scientists have some slightly unfortunate news for autumn aesthetics aficionados. Those crimson and gold-colored leaves may not be as abundant this year due to the ongoing long-term drought conditions in Champaign and neighboring counties. While not every deciduous tree is showing signs, enough trees are sporting noticeable bare patches where green, healthy leaves should be, completely skipping over the yellow and red color-changing process usually peaking in mid to late October. Not as spectacular are the words U of I Extension scientist Chris Evans said to describe this season's colors. The Southern Illinois-based forestry researcher said that any level of drought has been a persistent issue in years past, with this year being no exception. Champaign Park District arborist Ellie Ginger and Jean Burridge care for 8,000 trees in town and said all the trees are stressed from drought. Maple and European linden trees are some prime examples of trees showing stress. The drought's effects will be visible over the next few years, Burridge said. Because of this stress, trees will have reduced growth and a harder time recovering from diseases. The lack of rainfall has switched up from years prior, with most of the rain happening earlier this year. The park district staff planted trees in September with unforgivingly hard and dry soil, even in the top few inches that usually hold a good amount of moisture. Ginger said it could take up to 3 years for recently transplanted trees to start spreading their roots. In an attempt to curb the miserable conditions and keep the vulnerable trees alive, the employees started light watering newly planted trees within the last year, an hour at a time, with around 30 gallons. The late September saw less than an inch of rain, and that wasn't enough to help against the drought conditions, Ginger said. Since we're on a large scale, there's really not anything we can do to help. Leaves change color to preserve nutrients for the winter season. Inside leaves are parts of a cell that store energy from sunlight. A leaf's green light absorbing pigment is from chlorophyll. Leaves have an abundant amount of that green color, so as the winter months approach and sunlight availability is restricted, the chlorophyll starts to shut down, exposing the warm-toned color leaves have. With winter's colder conditions, trees have a harder time absorbing water from the frozen ground, so in order to preserve as much water, a tree loses its leaves, saving energy. The arborist said this year started off great, with ample rainfall encouraging growth, but at the end of the summer and the start of the fall, trees are starting to shut down, experiencing dieback because of the limited precipitation. With a third of the season's rainfall not present this year, trees undergoing dieback are now halting support to the outermost limbs in order to save nutrients. Some trees with larger leaf size are cutting losses with the smaller leaves, prioritizing bigger ones to help collect more sustenance from the sun before winter hits. For Champaign County, so far this year has had a 12-inch deficit in rain, only receiving about 20 inches of the normal 32 inches by October. Champaign's National Weather Service affiliation station recorded. In Thursday's report from the U.S. Drought Monitor, nearly 90% of Champaign County is in severe drought, with the northern portion making up the remaining 10% with moderately dry conditions. At the beginning of September, only 28% of the county was in severe drought, with the rest being in moderate drought. Additionally, the entire state is in a form of drought. In severe conditions, crop and pasture loss are likely, paired with water shortages. For farmers now harvesting, the dry fields are a fire threat. This year has been the warmest and driest year since the mid-2000s. This September had 7 days with temperatures over 90 degrees and a total rainfall accumulation of 1.91 inches. The observed normal rainfall for September is below just 3.5 inches. The average high temperature for the month was 84, up from the average of 78.8 degrees. The next warmest September was in 2007, with the same average temperatures as this year. The next driest September was in 2006, with a rainfall total of just 1.36 inches. The Climate Prediction Center foresees the drought persisting into December in its seasonal outlook charts, along with a 50% drop in precipitation events and a region-wide temperature increase of 50% to 60% until late October. "While the cards may seem bad," Evans said, "things aren't as dire as they appear." "We've had some good years, and we've had some bad years," Evan said. "I don't think it's going to be a horrible, horrible year, but it's just not going to be really showy." And in the next front page story, under Virginia Theater, the director, Ebertfest Gap will be filled. Renovations updates led to solid bookings for CU venue. The first Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival was presented at the Virginia Theater in 1999, with the film critic, now immortalized as a statue just outside the venue, working in tandem with the University of Illinois. The event, that would become known as Ebertfest, returned to the venue every year thereafter, except for 2020 and 2021 due to the COVID-19 pandemic, said theater director Stephen Bentz. However, 2 weeks ago, organizers announced that the film festival, which Bentz called a major highlight on Champaign's cultural calendar, is leaving Champaign-Urbana. When asked how this change will affect the Virginia, Bentz replied that film exhibition has undergone a radical shift in the last 10 years. In presenting its various movie series at the Virginia Theater, the Park District is now making the very best use of the venue's space and flexibility, including specially added programming, with most screenings and focusing on our media partnerships to show films that have had the greatest meaning for the public, he said. These partnerships, which Bentz discussed in a recent interview for Kathy's Mailbag, have included the News Gazette film series. Additionally, the theater is screening the documentary Observer at 3 p.m. Saturday in partnership with the Illinois Public Media and the U of I's Beckman Institute. Bentz added that spring is always a very busy time at the Virginia, and the theater expects to be able to fill in the gap left by the film festival, which was held in late April. He also said that each year the theater has played host to a growing number of large-scale, full-week local events, and touring headliners show that fill the Virginia with fans from East Central Illinois and beyond. Chaz Ebert, host of Ebertfest and widow of Roger and U of I College of Media Dean Tracy Sulkin, announced on September 19th that 2025 marked the festival's last year in Champaign-Urbana. "Financial considerations facing both universities and film festivals have led us to the conclusion that there is not a clearly sustainable path for the festival in its present form," the two women wrote, adding that Chaz and festival director Nate Cohn are actively exploring inspired ideas for reinventing Ebertfest and will be sharing updates as those plans crystallize. According to Bentz, the cost of renting the Virginia for the festival varied based on factors such as how many days the theater was used for the event, the number of screenings featured, and whether any live performances were included in the event. Over the last 3 years, The UVI's total venue costs for the event have ranged from $32,399 to $33,114, with these figures including not only rental fees but also ticketing, stagehands, and equipment use, he said. Additionally, Bence noted that organizers also had their own production expenses to account for, such as staff, marketing, film licensing, and travel costs. When asked about Ebertfest's impact on the Virginia, Bence said that the event benefited the theater in multiple ways. Ebertfest helped grow public awareness of the Virginia as a unique asset for cinema lovers, amplifying the venue's capacity to present high-quality films in an opulent space with state-of-the-art technology, and one of the largest screens downstate, Bence said. And just as importantly, every single ticket sold provided a contribution to the Champaign Parks Foundation's Virginia Theater Restoration Fund. Champaign Park District Executive Director Sarah Sandquist said in a previous interview that every ticket sold at the theater has $1 added onto it that goes into the Virginia Theater Restoration Fund. Over the years, contributions from Ebertfest and other events have helped the Park District restore the building to its original 1921 splendor, while also incorporating modern amenities such as a new sound system and lighting upgrades, Bence said. The fund also helped cover the cost of fly system control upgrades at the theater, which closed from January to early April of this year to facilitate the project. Ebertfest was one of the first events held at the Virginia after the work was completed. It is indeed a loss for our community to see Ebertfest move on, and at the Virginia we're sharing in that loss with patrons, staffs, and volunteers, many of whom more or less planned their spring around this event, Bence said. It's an unfortunate thing, but we do understand that programs change and evolve, and we're looking forward to hearing from the festival's organizers what the future will hold. In our last front page article with the University of Illinois, Gies Memorial Stadium Wi-Fi suffers delays. It'll be a while longer before 60,000 Illini fans can count on texting or posting consistently while watching football from inside Gies Memorial Stadium. Plans for an all-new high-density Wi-Fi system for the stadium, approved by the University of Illinois trustees in May, back before the Gies name was, have been delayed, athletics officials told the News Gazette. The $10 million project will eventually bring internet connectivity throughout the stadium as well as Grange Grove. In June, Illini Athletics announced that the system would be active in the concourses for the August 29th season opener and that Wi-Fi access would expand to the Seating Bowl, Students Section, and Grange Grove by September 27th. Now, athletic officials say the concourse and entry gates will have Wi-Fi by the next home game, a week from Saturday against reigning champion Ohio State, and that student section will begin to get access for the November 1st game against Rutgers. The timeline for the rest of the Seating Bowl remains unknown. We ran into some delays in the contracting process as well as in our ability to acquire all of the hardware necessary, said Deputy Director of Athletics Roger Denny. When it's up and running, the Wi-Fi will be accessible to fans and also run stadium operations, including ticketing, concessions, and security. Event revenue, donations, and private grants covered the cost of the project, according to the university. Denny said the Wi-Fi system will absolutely be able to take on the volume of traffic expected at the stadium during a sold-out game. The system is being built to handle most of our aggressive estimates of required capacity, he said. Ideally, that means fans will be able to use social media, text, and access the internet, all of which have been difficult to do in any sort of with any sort of large crowd present. That's been the case all season, with three of the first four home games, including Ohio State, sold out. Denny said that the focus now is on installing the system and making it accessible and reliable, but that once it's in place, there are plans to look at additional features and functionality. Over time, we'll also build new wayfinding and push notification abilities into the system, he said. Installing such a major system has meant placing miles of both fiber optic and Category 6 Ethernet cables, as well as over 1,400 access points throughout the stadium. Almost every one of those access points will require core drilling through the concrete stands and connecting each to one another through conduit and wire trays throughout and under the stadium, Denny said. And we have quite a few obituaries today. We have Charles DeWard Bundy, 87, of Clinton, died at 11:36 a.m. Thursday, October 2nd, 2025, at Goldwater Care, Clinton. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Calvert Funeral Home, 201 South Center in Clinton. Leslie Cuthrell, 82, of Mohammed, died at 8:40 p.m. Wednesday, October 1st, 2025, at home. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Owens Funeral Home, 101 North Elm Street in Champaign. Gerald Hall, 43, of Danville, died at 4:54 p.m. Sunday, September 28th, at OSF Sacred Heart Medical Center in Danville. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Leakin Sons Funeral Home, 304 East Williams Street in Danville. Virgil Brian Hart, 72, of Philo, left for heaven at 2:55 a.m. Wednesday, October 1st, 2025, from his home. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Monday, October 6th at St. Matthew Lutheran Church, 2200 Philo Road in Urbana. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. at the church. Burial will follow in Locust Grove Cemetery. Carol A. Hunter, Carol Ann Hunter, passed away peacefully at her home on Saturday, September 27th, 2025, in Savoy. And I'm looking for the arrangements here. A celebration of life will be held at First Presbyterian Church, 302 West Church Street in Champaign, on Sunday, October 12th at 2 p.m. Daniel McNamara, 70, of Paxton, died at 4:08 p.m. Wednesday, October 1st, at Carl Foundation Hospital, Urbana. A gathering of family and friends for a celebration of life will be at 5 p.m. Wednesday at the McNamara home in Paxton. Bear Family Funeral Services, 406 East Pell Street in Paxton, is in charge of the arrangements. And Sherry Paul, 73, of Tolono, died Friday, September 26, 2025, at Accolade Healthcare of Paxton on Pells in Paxton. Private family services will be held at a later date. Freeze Funeral Home, 407 North Bourne Street in Tolono, is in charge of the arrangements. Steve Stumborg of Tolono, 34 years old, died Tuesday, September 30th, 2025, as a result of injuries sustained in a tragic automobile accident. Visitation will be on Monday, October 6th, from noon to 2 p.m. at Freeze Funeral Home, Tolono, with the funeral service at 2 p.m. Burial will immediately follow in Locust Grove Cemetery in Philo. And last, we have Kaywin C. Wheatley, 21, of Lafayette, Indiana, formerly of Champaign, died Monday, September 29th, in Chicago. Funeral services will be at noon, October 11th, at Leakin Sun, 1215 West Bradley Avenue, in Urbana. Visitation will be at 11 a.m., October 11th, at the funeral home. And we also have a celebrity obituary celebrated primatologist conservationist dies at age 91. Jane Goodall, the intellectual, soft-spoken conservationist renowned for her groundbreaking, immersive chimpanzee field research, in which she documented the primates' distinct personalities and use of tools, has died at 91. And in our more state news, inside state's $50.6 billion six-year infrastructure plan. State government officials on Wednesday unveiled Illinois' new six-year $50.6 billion infrastructure plan for roads, bridges, railways, airports, and more. The plan spans all 102 counties and includes $32.5 billion over 6 years for roads and bridges, includes $25.7 billion for the state system, and $6.8 billion for the local system. It covers 8.4 million square feet of bridges and 7,107 miles of roads, according to the Illinois Department of Transportation. The local funding will cover 1,654 lane miles and more than 1.3 million square feet of bridge deck. The state unveiled a new multi-year plan each year, Governor J.B. Pritzker said. This year's is the largest ever. You can't drive or bike or ride or walk anywhere in the state without seeing and feeling the impact of the modernization that is underway in Illinois, Pritzker said at a Wednesday news conference in Chicago announcing the plan. From Chicago to Rockford, from Decatur to Springfield, to Carbondale to Metropolis, no region of the state has been left out of this program. About half of the road and bridge funding, or $5.8 billion, is expected to come from the federal government, with $1.6 billion coming from bond proceeds, $1.3 billion from local reimbursements, and $13.8 billion in state funds. How Illinois funds transportation. State funding is largely made possible by legislation dubbed Rebuild Illinois that passed on bipartisan vote in Pritzker's first year in office in 2019. Road and bridge funding comes mostly from the state's road fund, which is separate from the general revenue fund, which largely sustained the state's day-to-day operation. I'll remind you that we passed that bill years before the federal government finally got around to passing a major infrastructure bill, Pritzker said. The road fund's main feeder is the state's motor fuel tax, which lawmakers in 2019 pegged to increase with inflation each year, creating the funding mechanism that allows for the road and bridge investment. The current rate is 48.3 cents per gallon of gasoline and 55.8 cents per gallon of diesel. The funding bill also raised the price of vehicle registration starting in 2020, which for most passenger vehicles is $151 a year. Since 2019, Rebuild Illinois has dedicated $20.8 billion, including 21,309 miles of road improvements, 815 bridge projects, and 1,181 safety improvements. Multimode plan. The multimodal portion of the plan, covering public transit, rail, aviation, and marine infrastructure, is slated to receive $18.1 billion over 6 years, including state, federal, local, and private funds, according to IDOT. Of that, $13.8 billion is for 90 transit projects, $2.9 billion for 29 rail projects, $1.2 billion for 244 aviation projects, and $197 million for 28 marine projects, according to IDOT. Notable projects include $388 million for connecting Chicago and the Quad Cities via passenger rail, with an intermediate stop in Geneseo, between $2 million and $5 million each for airports in the Metro East, Lansing, Rockford, Whiteside County, and Peoria, and $175 million to the Chicago Transit Authority for a training and control center facility. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit organization, news service that reported on this article. And some news coming out of Danville, Habitat for Humanity of Danville. Firefighters lend a hand in home build for veteran. Several members of Danville's firefighting Local 429 got their hands dirty on their day off Thursday, helping with Habitat for Humanity of Danville's home build for veteran Mark Whaling. It certainly wasn't a first for the local first responders, who have helped with many Habitat projects. In 2012, for instance, firefighters, police officers, and ambulance personnel helped Habitat of Danville build its 50th home as a part of the September 11th National Day of Service and Remembrance. Danville Fire Lieutenant Brian Hogg and firefighter Matt Goodner weren't involved with those previous Habitat projects, but were proud to assist with this one, where they worked on flooring and some other pieces. "They set us up on cutting these trusses, and that's our job," Goodner said. So far, Hogg said, adding that he was the holder and measurer guy. Goodner and Hogg said they're absolutely glad to help out. "Mike kind of put a tape measure and saw in my hands and said, 'Get to work,'" Goodner said. "Any hands help," said Ryan Campbell, executive director of the local Habitat chapter. Other groups are being scheduled to help too, including the Rotary Club and Danville High School's junior ROTC. "It's hard to have a volunteer group come in and do kind of what we've been doing so far with the pouring of the concrete, and the block work is not the most fun," Campbell said. "We want to try to bring in the volunteers for the fun part of the job and not break their backs. The police department has offered to help, possibly with the trusses, and many businesses have also been assisting in the process. Everybody I speak to, when they find out it's for Habitat, let alone for a veteran's build, everybody's been overly excited to get involved." The hot, largely dry weather has been a blessing for what we're doing, especially the time of year we're trying to do it, Campbell said. Groundbreaking for the new home in the 1400 block of Sherman Street was a little more than a month ago. In the time since, the foundation has been poured and work continues on building the home from the ground up. Campbell predicted that next year would see the start of framing, walls, windows, and sheeting. After that will come work on trusses and other parts of the roof, with plans being to see it closed up for the year prior to winter's weather arriving. He said the builders are in good hands with construction manager Rob Switter and longtime Habitat volunteer Cundiff with Serve Together. Habitat Board President Eric Hanna, who has been involved with the local organization for about 25 years, was also helping out Thursday. "The best part of it is the people you work with," Hanna said. "It's the great people you work with. I really enjoy doing this." Whaling said he also has been putting in sweat equity on his new home almost every day when he doesn't have health issues or a doctor's appointment. So far, he's gotten some first-time experience in placing cinder blocks and mixed mortar. Whaling's he's both excited and scared to become a first-time homeowner, adding he doesn't think he's worthy of the home and acknowledging it will put him in a better financial situation. He said he has already started his sweat equity on an earlier Habitat house rehab on Franklin Street, and he's learning how to lay flooring, put in doors, and trim and hang ceilings. We'll take a short break now and return for the second half hour of the News Gazette, dated October 3rd, 2025. Please stay tuned.